right. Well, the Bible study topic that I have for you today is going to be on Babylon. On Babylon, a lot of this is going to be historical in nature. And so I've tried to go through and flesh out some of this. Hopefully you find this interesting. I know when I had put all of this together, I did find it interesting. And, you know, frequently in the Bible, you see Babylon that's mentioned. And we all know, as soon as you hear Babylon, boy, your ears perk up, and what's it talking about? What do we need to be aware of? Especially the end time, in Revelation, you see that all over. We know that it represents an evil system. We know that it represents a system that Satan is going to use to oppose Jesus Christ at his second coming. But have we ever stopped to think about why Babylon? If you pick a city to represent the wrong system of this world, why Babylon? Why didn't you pick Rome? You know, I've seen things. You go on the internet and people have all kinds of prophetic things. You know, they keep saying that the United States is the beast. New York City, you know, and they say, well, that's the beast because that should be the Babylon because that's where the UN is and all these different things. But why Babylon? You know, so I want to delve into that today, and I want to go through some of the historical aspects of Babylon and then project that forward into the future of what we know. And many, many years ago, back in the Worldwide Church of God, they had this booklet, and it was titled Babylon, Past, Present, and Future. And I use that book. I've got a copy of that little booklet there, and that's part of, you know, where I pulled my information from today. It's kind of reference material to be able to present that to you with the history of Babylon. And we're going to then see how Babylon was used and why it is going to be used at the end time. So hopefully you find this interesting. Now, when we think of places in the Bible where events took place, we usually picture things like Bethlehem or Nazareth, you know, places around, certainly Jerusalem for sure, or Galilee, perhaps Egypt. You know, places like that is what comes to mind when we start talking about cities. But, you know, much of the Bible took place in lands that were literally hundreds of miles away from these places. It took place in what is known as Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. This area is also known as the cradle of civilization, and they believe, no way of knowing, of course, but they believe that's where the Garden of Eden was, and therefore that's where we started out. Today, much of ancient Mesopotamia lies within the border of Iraq. Definitely not a nice place to be these days. Its most famous city was Babylon. Now, Babylon, the name Babylon, literally means the gate of God. The gate of God. And it was once one of the most elaborate and influential cities of the world. We'll go through some of that, some of the description of what that city was like here in a bit. Today, there's nothing left. What was Babylon is totally in ruins. And there's a small section that has been excavated by archaeologists, and there's a part of it that's being restored in an archaeological park by the Iraqi Department of Antiquities. So what they're finding, and you can see different aspects of Babylon that have been dug up over the years. I believe in Germany they have a dedicated to that, and it has some of the gates and some of the reliefs and the mosaics and things like that. But, you know, most of that ancient city is still buried beneath the sand. Even the river that once flowed through this magnificent city no longer goes there. It has totally changed its course. But Babylon lives on in a different way, even though it doesn't physically exist. Like Jerusalem, like Rome, Babylon is more than a geographical location. The name Babylon has come to symbolize utter confusion. It has come to symbolize mankind's resistance toward God. Twice in the past, once more in the future, and we'll look at the different areas in the past, God has reached in and intervened when it came to the city of Babylon. You're going to see where man attempts to build this Babylon, this great civilization, this great city, and God intervened. And so for that reason, the story of Babylon is recorded in history and prophecy does hold an important lesson for us today. So let's go through some of this. The writers of the Bible chronicled ancient Babylon in order to give insight into our world today, to show us what it was like, and then also to project that forward into the future. And so today we're going to look and see what history reveals to us, and what we'll see is that history then holds the key to the future. Babylon first appeared in the Bible after the Great Flood, so it did not exist before the Flood. Noah's sons migrated to the land of Shinar, that later became known as Babylon or Babylonia. See, at that time, after the Flood, God wanted people to go out over the entire earth, to spread out over the entire earth. But what we see is Noah's descendants had other ideas. Instead, they decided to unite together. They decided to become their own authority. And so let's pick up the story there, Genesis, in Genesis 11 and verse 4. Genesis 11 and verse 4. I know Genesis is in here. Here we go. 11, verse 4. This is talking about the Tower of Babel. And in verse 4, it says, "And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city, and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, let we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." And you notice how diametrically opposite that was according to what God wanted. God wanted people to spread out, and they said, no, we're going to make a name for whom? Ourselves. We see this selfishness popping up. Now, according to Josephus, we're told that the person that united all of these people was none other than the gentleman by the name of Nimrod. That was Noah's great-grandson. Let's read a little bit about Nimrod. Go to chapter 10 now of Genesis, verses 8 and 9. Chapter 10, verse 8 and 9. And it says, "Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord." So he's this great-grandson of Noah. It sounds to be a pretty prominent title and everything. He sounds like quite a stand-up guy when it describes him as this mighty hunter against the Lord. Or before the Lord, as it says. You know, so that sounds like, quite a guy. But Adam Clark, his commentary, has this to say about Nimrod. He said this, he says, "Nimrod began to be a mighty man of sin, a murderer of innocent men, a rebel before the Lord." And you read up on this, and he's one of these guys that would, you know, had the game where you would capture somebody and you would turn them loose and then you would go hunt them. You know, and so he was a very vile man. And yes, he was very powerful and all of that, but he was a very evil man. And he was a great leader. But his efforts were to lead the people away from God, not toward God, to lead them to him, to focus them on him. Because when he did that, he realized they no longer focused themselves on God. This was not too long after the Flood. So what Nimrod built after the Flood was the first post-Flood collective anti-God civilization of human beings that was recorded in the pages of the Bible. It's called Babylon. It was a symbol of defiance. You notice we just read, "Let us take for ourselves." They were wanting to take it upon themselves. They defied God. So you have to ask the question of what was the Tower of Babel? And unfortunately, you know, we don't have any exact drawings of it. We don't have any pictures to know for sure. There are many artists out there. You'll see many fanciful renditions of what it was. But in all probability, it was probably much like what they call a ziggurat, or it was basically looked like a pyramid with great big steps in it. You know, have a flat surface and build another section on top of it. In all reality, that's probably what it was. It's like a stepped pyramid, had a flat top, and there was probably a temple that was located on top of it. And where they built this, the plains of Shinar, is utterly flat, much like the rice fields here in Arkansas. And it said that if you had a tower that was 100 feet tall, it would have been seen for miles. So God allowed this work to go on. He allowed them to build this tower, at least for a while. And he only let it go so far, and then he intervened. Let's go back to chapter 11, verses 5 through 9. Again, this is right after verse 4, where you know all the people are saying, come, let us do all of these things. And in verse 5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they began to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse the language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. So notice here, they're of one language, they're of one common thought. And the consensus here, God is saying, you know, if they have that one language, just think of all the things that they'll be able to do. And as opposed to that, you know, I mean, he was meaning for evil. You know, the people, they're not going to all get together and do all these things for good. It's going to be for evil. You know, look at today. Yes, we're still many languages, but we have the tools, we have the technology to be able to communicate as if it was one language. And you can look at all of the things that are going on. And most of it is not good. But here in Babel, so God came and he confused the languages. And at that point, the workers could no longer understand one another. Let alone, you know, all these people that were making plans for all of it. They couldn't understand one another. So the building of the city, the building of the tower, then comes to an abrupt halt. And what you find is all of these people, and they then broke into groups according to their like languages now, and they did begin to migrate over the earth, which is what God had intended to begin with. So in Hebrew, as it says here, the name became Babel. In Greek, it's translated Babylon. And so this story of ancient Babel was written down, as so much of the Old Testament was, to teach us an important lesson. See, God has tolerance up to a point. Even with the human pride and rebellion, up to a point. But then it has its limits. So very early on, what we're seeing of this Babylon, it is a symbol of the opposition of God. And so it gives us this first glimpse of a civilization that's organized against God and hatred against God. In fact, as we go through here, you're going to see human pride, this selfishness, is a consistent theme whenever the Bible mentions Babylon. It's like they go hand in hand. This self-centeredness equals Babylon. It's that attitude. So the Tower of Babel was God's first intervention into Babylon, but it wouldn't be his last. And what we see through history, two centuries passed on, and then we see Babylon reemerging on the world scene. And this time it was under the Amorites. They founded a dynasty there around 2000 B.C. So this was, roughly what David and Solomon were about 1000 B.C. So this was 1,000 years before David and Solomon. Historians call this the Old Babylonian Empire. The most famous king of this empire was a king named Hammurabi. Now, during his reign, one of Hammurabi's greatest desires was to bring all of Mesopotamia under one rule, under one person, ironically. Not just one rule, but of course it would have to be under him. But to achieve this goal, Hammurabi sought control over the Euphrates River. And to do this, he engaged in conflicts with several of his neighbors, his neighboring city-states. Eventually, he became the guy in charge. He devoted his time to construction projects, to internal reforms that he had going. And along with that, You find that trade flourished during his reign. Babylon became the cultural, intellectual capital of the empire. Science and astrology were highly valued, highly advanced in Babylon. For example, the ancient Babylonians came up with the idea of a 60-minute hour. They also came up with the idea of a circle being 360 degrees, which is kind of deep. So this enticement of trade and success were then blended in with religion. They blended all these things together. Babylon, as we said before, the name means gate of God, was actually a prominent religious center. And it boasted some of the most striking temples in all of the ancient world. They worshiped many gods, many surrounding the forces of nature. In ancient times, you find that whoever controlled the religion controlled the people. It's kind of a way of controlling people. They believed that their king represented a god in many different forms. You see that through civilization throughout time. For example, the Egyptians. You know, their leader was God, in effect. It's ironic. You look at the Catholic Church. Their leader is the representative of God. And so they were among the first to fuse religion and politics together. And it came up with this. That's how they governed. Government and religion combined. Perhaps Hammurabi, and perhaps you've heard of him, he's best known for his set of laws that have been preserved to this day. Famous Code of Hammurabi. Based on the older collections of Sumerian and Akkadian ordinances, it was one of the first law codes in history. Perhaps you've seen it. There's actually a black, it's a pillar, and it's some 7 feet tall, it's polished, and it bears this etching of Hammurabi receiving the laws from their sun god by the name of Shamash. He was the god of justice. This pillar stands about 7 feet high, carries more than 4,000 lines of Akkadian cuneiform script, contains nearly 300 legal provisions. These laws that he came up with were written down. It wasn't just word of mouth. He inscribed them on this pillar. Now, his code was unique in many aspects. And when people deciphered it, it covers business, criminal, family, agricultural matters. And it was far more comprehensive. It was far more detailed than what any civilization before it had ever put down. Its main principle was that the strong may not oppress the weak, which sounds like a good principle. Now, Hammurabi reigned for more than four decades. He forged one of the great but short-lived empires of ancient Mesopotamia. Today, very little of what was there in Hammurabi's time even remains of that Babylon. He laid the basis for a civilization that would endure for centuries after his death. You know, he laid that foundation with the rules, with the laws, and it did last for several hundred years. But it was a civilization that was based on power, prestige, pursuit of wealth. Had very little to do with a creator or the knowledge of a creator God. Now, after about 400 years, the Hittites overthrew the Babylonian Empire. Later on, the Assyrians conquered Babylon. It would be centuries after that before Babylon would rise again as an independent power. And the first great age of Babylon had ended at that point. And you know, you throw around these concepts of centuries. You know, and you read right over that. You know, that's this country's only been around for, what, less than 250 years. And there's a lot that's happened. And when you talk about 400 years and it just rolls off the tongue like nothing, that's a long time. There's a lot of things that happen. Now, ancient Assyria was actually one of Babylon's chief rivals. In 689 B.C., the Assyrian army pillaged and burned the city. Now, they not only pillaged and burned the city, they didn't want it to, not even remotely, to be there. They never wanted it rebuilt again. So they tore it down and they threw the rubble into the Euphrates River so that you wouldn't even have material there to rebuild on. The Assyrians flooded the city. Its foundations were even destroyed. They thought they had destroyed Babylon forever. But this site of ancient Babylon was eventually rebuilt by the Chaldeans. And so what we see on the world scene almost 1,000 years after Hammurabi, again, it rolls right off the tongue, 1,000 years. That's a long time. So 1,000 years after Hammurabi, you find Babylon once again a world power. This time, though, it's now ruled by a crown prince of Babylon by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. He was to become Babylon's greatest ruler by far. So he started about 25 years old. Now, under Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon grew to become the most impressive city of its time, the largest city on earth at that time. The Greek historian Herodotus declared that it surpassed in splendor any city in the known world. Its population exceeded 200,000. So for that point in time, that was a large city. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's city included immense fortification. In the ancient world, Babylon was the most fortified city that there was. It had two walls, an inner wall and an outer wall. They were impossible to scale, impossible to breach. You had 100 gates of bronze that were set in an impregnable wall, which was buttressed at regular intervals by defensive towers. In addition to that, Nebuchadnezzar also undertook a vast rebuilding program. His impressive architecture, the splendor of Babylon, had no equal in all of Mesopotamia. Its chief feature was the great temple of Marduk, the chief of the Babylonian gods. The central feature of this temple was a statue reportedly made from 22 tons of gold. Imagine how much that would be worth, 22 tons of gold. Now, just to the north was a tower that was known as the house that is the foundation of heaven and earth. So they also had a tower, a temple, at that point in time in Babylon. It was a seven-story tower topped by a temple in magnificent blue glaze. So you have this huge tower, and on top of it is this huge blue building. It was reportedly built on the very location of the Tower of Babel many centuries later. And it was said to have been 300 feet tall. It's the same height, basically, as the Statue of Liberty that we have in New York Harbor. It's quite a building to be perched up there. And from the temple, you had this paved processional way led northward to the spectacular Ishtar Gate. Perhaps you've seen the pictures of this Ishtar Gate. They've actually reconstructed part of that. I think that part of that's in Germany. But it was decorated with these magical bulls and dragons that were molded in relief in these colorful glazed brickwork. And all through the avenue as you walked along on the walls, you had these enameled lions that continued through the Ishtar Gate to the temple that lay outside the city walls. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's immense royal palace contained five great courtyards. His throne lay directly to the south of the central courtyard, and Greek tradition refers to the palace's magnificent hanging gardens as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Perhaps you've heard of that. But that was in Babylon. That was something that Nebuchadnezzar did. Must have been quite a sight to see. Again, we have no pictures. We have no way of knowing what it was actually like. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, he was ambitious, he was capable, and he also planned on this extensive building program of palaces, temples, waterways, for his temple, or for his city. See, and under his rulership, it became the most impressive city the world had ever seen. But there was a dark side to the city of Babylon, because it was also the center of decadence, sensuality. They were cut off from the true God. They knew nothing of God. They didn't want to know God. They were addicted to commerce through idolatry. So Babylon's moral decadence plummeted to the point that it was known as the cesspool of vice. That's quite a distinction. You had this city that was so beautiful and so great on one side, and yet on the other side was rotten at its core. And see, in the ancient Near East, that prostitution and things like that were not unheard of, but Babylon just magnified all of that. Babylon was just the opposite, the total, utter opposite of the way of God. So they were obsessed with their evil pleasures. They were filled with pride over their great achievements. You had all these people in Babylon. And like their king, they drifted steadily toward a day of reckoning. Like I said, God only lets it go so far. This is the case here. See, what Nebuchadnezzar didn't realize is that his rise to power was actually part of a divine plan. He was part of a plan. See, that proud king, he saw himself as the undisputed master of the world at his point in time. And so God took that moment and used it as a teaching moment to teach him, all that followed him, who really controlled the destiny of the nations. His empire would now confront a nation that was unlike any of the other nations that he had conquered. That nation was Judah. It's a remnant of the kingdom of Israel. Been established by God, and he'd led their ancestors out of Egyptian captivity more than 800 years earlier. So their destiny depended not on their military power, as Nebuchadnezzar's was, or the strength of their alliances. Their power derived directly from their reliance and obedience to God's law. So along comes Nebuchadnezzar to Judah, and he demands subjugation. He demands tribute from the kingdom of Judah. And by this time, Judah was in serious decline. They were on the downhill slide. Several times, the Babylonians would invade. Each time, they took away captives. They took away treasure. Jerusalem fell. The temple was destroyed in July of 587 BC by Nebuchadnezzar. And so at that point in time, Nebuchadnezzar basically gutted out the temple before he destroyed it. And he took the most intelligent and capable of the foreign captives back to Babylon to receive special training in language and literature of the Chaldeans to educate them in the ways of Babylon. So at this point, what we see is a stage being set for this very unusual partnership between the great Babylonian king and a young Jewish captive by the name of Daniel. And we find the story of Daniel's relationship with that king in the book that bears the name of Daniel. But what neither Daniel nor Nebuchadnezzar understood is that they were living at a very landmark time in history, a very pivotal point in all of history is happening with their interaction. So in a series of dramatic visions, God began to outline the course of future events. It began with a strange dream that Nebuchadnezzar had one night, and he brought all of his magicians, his astrologers, into his court, and he told them what he dreamed, and he asked them to interpret, and they could not. So Daniel was summoned. With God's help, he was able to explain what that dream meant. And in Daniel 2, he reminded the king that he had seen this great image, had a head of gold, had a chest and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, feet of iron mixed with clay. He described that image to the king. And then he explained the meaning of that image. And he told the king it represents a succession of world-ruling empires that would dominate the world from that moment until the end. So Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon was only the first. It was represented by that head of gold on that image. Later it would fall to be replaced by three other world-ruling empires. And eventually, as the image went on, God would destroy the last of these empires and at that point would establish his kingdom and dominance over all of the earth. As you can imagine, you know, Nebuchadnezzar thought that he was king of the world at that point in time. He didn't want to hear that. Wasn't he the all-powerful king of kings? Wasn't he going to live forever? Wasn't he the one that was addressed, "O king, live forever"? Everyone addressed you that way, sooner or later you're going to believe it yourself. His Babylon, his city, was the greatest that the world had ever seen. It's unthinkable in his mind that the glory would fade. But God was giving this king a lesson in humility at this point in time. He was at first reluctant to accept that. But see, God was now using this situation with Nebuchadnezzar to teach, not just Nebuchadnezzar, but all that have ever followed in positions of leadership. And he's telling them, he's teaching them an all-important lesson. Let's notice that. Let's go to the book of Daniel now. Daniel 4, verses 34 through 37. Daniel 4, starting in verse 37, or 34, I'm sorry. So when you come upon it, even before that, you see where Nebuchadnezzar has been humiliated, and he's been made into an animal, basically. So now we see here in verse 34, and at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor, my splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. So you have this great Nebuchadnezzar, and you know, and we don't know what it was like when he was basically turned into an animal. Here it does say that his reasoning, his thinking returned to him. You know, so at some point in time, all of that left him. I mean, did he go mad? Was all of it just taken away? We don't know. But at that point, he was that ultimate ruler. You know, so it says here he learned his lesson. When his reasoning returned, he realized that he was nothing. And it says that, you know, he then extolled the name of God. It says he praised, extolled, honor the King of heaven. He realized, you know, this O King live forever was not him. So he was there, and he was humbled by this event. So it appears Nebuchadnezzar had learned an important lesson. As great as he thought he was, here he is again, selfish. He was then taken down by God. But, you know, God didn't just take him out. God set him down, and then God restored him so that he could see how far down he had come. And so he learned an important lesson, but his successors did not. You know, and God didn't do this kind of thing for every ruler that came after Nebuchadnezzar. And we see that Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 43 years. He died in 562 BC. Now, to show you how great of hands his kingdom was in, he was succeeded by four kings in a period of 7 years. And everyone that succeeded him was weaker than the one before it. So it didn't take long. After he died, things began to fall apart. And so then we come to the Babylonian ruler by the name of Belshazzar. Now Belshazzar was a proud, an arrogant man. In fact, he was just as proud and arrogant as Nebuchadnezzar had once been. And by this time that he comes on the scene, Babylon is now besieged by enemies. But what we see is Belshazzar remains unconcerned. He's trusting that the city's formidable defenses, those great walls, those great mighty gates would keep him safe. In Daniel 5, we read that he planned a great feast. He was basically thumbing his nose at all those that were outside the gates. It's a great show of conceit. And through this feast, he ordered the drinks, the meal, to be served in golden goblets and on plates that, guess where they came from? The temple in Jerusalem. So not only was he thumbing his nose at the enemies at the gates, he's thumbing his nose at the great God. And even as he sat feasting, the party was stunned into silence. as a mysterious hand appeared to begin to write on the wall of the throne room. And it wrote a message on there, and the kings, he called all of his magicians, and they couldn't understand it. And once again, you know, somebody thought, hey, I remember way back when there was this guy Daniel. And Daniel had retired by then. He was quite old, but he was summoned. Please explain what's going on. And when he saw it, he explained that that writing was a message from God, that God will be bringing that proud rule of Belshazzar to an end. In other words, he said, you're finished. Babylon is finished. The kingdom would be divided between the Medes and the Persians, who were at that time outside the gates of the city. They were just on the verge of entering into the city. See, on that night in October 539 BC, God intervened again into the affairs of Babylon. See, what happened was a dramatic confirmation of God's hand in history. God had prophesied the end of Babylon in detailed prophecy. He had delivered it through Isaiah nearly 200 years before. You know, and this is one of the great prophecies of the Bible. This is one of these, one of the reasons that we state that the Bible is true, because of declared prophecy. And this is one of those. Isaiah prophesied that God would make it possible for a king, and he named the king Cyrus. And he said, this King Cyrus is going to conquer many kingdoms that ultimately would make up his empire. Let's notice that in Isaiah 45, verses 1 through 3. Let's try that. Isaiah 45, starting in verse 1. Remember, this is some 200 years before this actually happened. Isaiah 45, verse 1. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to his, the one that he has set apart. And he names him, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held to subdue nations before him, to loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double doors so that the gates will not be shut. I will go before you. Will make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of bronze and cut the bars of iron. I will give you the treasure of darkness and the hidden riches of secret places, that you may know that I, the Lord, who call you by name, am the God of Israel. So God is saying, here's proof. This is going to happen. Now it mentions in here these double doors that would not be shut or locked. It was a reference to the remarkable way in which Cyrus was able to conquer the city of Babylon. See, with its massive high walls, Babylon appeared impregnable from the outside, if you were trying to get in from the outside. So when Cyrus's main army encamped around the city, what you see is the Babylonians laughed. See, they had been warned in advance that Cyrus was coming. They had stored up provisions. They had enough provisions in there to feed them for many years. They could survive a siege indefinitely at that point. But unknown to the Babylonians, Cyrus was implementing an ingenious plan. See, he stationed some of his men up the Euphrates River there, and they began to divert the river. They cut out a diverting channel. You know, and so what they did is they redirected the flow of the river. And the river ran through the city, and when they redirected the river, the water began to go down, and the gates of the city were exposed. And so then, at that point, then the Persians were able to wade under the gates. As the river went down, the gates only went so far beneath the surface, they were able to walk under the gate, under the cover of darkness. And apparently, Cyrus also had a spy that was able to get into the city. And on that appropriate night, when they started this, he unlocked a set of gates, the prophesied double doors, as we see here in Isaiah, and the wall that stretched along the bank of the river. And so as the army went under the gates, as they began to pour through this open gate, Cyrus's army swarmed into the metropolis. The Babylonians were caught totally by surprise. They offered no effective resistance. Now, Babylon was so large that even as the armies were starting to take over in the outer parts of the city, those living in the center of Babylon still had no idea what was going on. That's exactly what Belshazzar was doing. He was not in the middle of the city. He was celebrating, which may have been a New Year festival. And they were continuing on in their merriment, their partying, until the truth became apparent. By that time, it was way too late. The greatest city in the ancient world had fallen. See, again, like in the time of Nimrod, God would only stand for so much evil before he stepped in and intervened. So he'd intervened twice in Babylon. The time of the head of gold was now over. Now, the empire represented by the chest and the arms of silver was now about to take place. It would have its place in the world for a season. That was a Medo-Persian empire that ruled over Babylon, many countries, for just over two centuries. And then it too fell. And it fell to a gentleman by the name of Alexander the Great, who was the belly and the thighs of bronze that Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his image. Alexander wanted to make Babylon the city of his empire. But unfortunately, his dreams were cut short when he died of a fever. He died like at, 32 years old, something like that. He was still quite young. And tradition has it he died in the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar's old palace. So he was there in Babylon when he died. In the years that followed, the desert slowly took over. Babylon's temples, their palaces, slowly crumbled away. You had shifting sands that buried the parks, the waterways. The river even changed its course so it no longer flowed through that area. Nebuchadnezzar's once great city was no more. And again, today they're just beginning to, you know, dig up bits and pieces of it. We're in Isaiah. Let's go to Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13, verses 19 through 20. Isaiah 13, and starting in verse 19. And Babylon, here again, the city, Babylon, glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, God overthrew with fire, totally destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So he's talking about Babylon being just like that. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation. Nor will the Arabian pitch tents there. Nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. So it's talking about a time at the end of Babylon as a city. So how could it continue on? How could it be relevant even today? It's because it lived on as an idea. Even Alexander the Great was seduced by its great legacy some 200 years after its fall. Now, the Bible tells us of another Babylon. You know, in the book of Revelation, at the time of the end, it speaks of another Babylon. And it speaks of this Babylon as being the greatest one of all. As we've already seen, for example, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon was one of the wonders of the ancient world. But we see this new Babylon mentioned in that last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. It is not Babylon the city that is being referenced here, but rather Babylon an ideology, an attitude that it now talks about. Remember I talked about earlier that whenever you see Babylon, it's usually with a selfish, self-centered attitude. It's this epitome of a civilization opposed to God. And it represents the height of human power. You know, you saw that with Hammurabi. You saw that with Nimrod. You saw that with Nebuchadnezzar. They thought they were the height of human power. That's what it's going to represent as, at the end time, a system. that's going to represent the height of human power in all ages. People of God have lived within this environment, this system of a spiritual Babylon, a godless world, a world in pursuit of the physical, of the material. We see that all so much today as well, don't we? A godless world. See, today, back and even like then, little thought was given to the spiritual realm. Little thought was given to the kingdom of God. So as we have seen, this is the Babylonian pattern that goes on out there. In that sense, Babylon is still with us today. Those that live in this godless world represents Babylon. You know, and you look at that when you frame it in that frame of mind. Babylon was a great physical city. And if you look at that as an ideology today, people that are godless are becoming greater and greater. So when the New Testament wants to picture evil and defiance of God, and you begin to picture these things reaching their ultimate fulfillment, the Bible then uses a phrase that it digs into that we can now relate to, and that is Babylon the Great. This phrase is found in the final book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And the events as you go into the book of Revelation talk about the end of the age. And it talks about a world that's very different than the one we know today. Revelation is set in the future. But as we know and as we believe, it is not the distant future. And in it, it describes a whole series of events that are going to happen to mankind, to bring mankind to a crisis point unparalleled in history. Again, mankind's going to reach up and have that attitude of Babylon. You know, the greatest that ever lived. Let's pick up the story in chapter 17 of Revelation. At a point where centuries of greed and violence, mismanagement, have gotten to the point where they finally catch up with the human race. And that's what we find going on now. We're in the midst of that. This greed, this violence. And what we find at this point of the story, we're going to see vast areas of the earth that have been ravaged by war, by famine, by disease. You see a civilization that's poised right on the edge of disaster. The world affairs are dominated by a strange power. Revelation 17 and verse 3. It says, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." Now, as we know, much of the information that we see in the book of Revelation is revealed to us in these symbols. And you see these symbols, and you have to let the Bible interpret itself with these symbols. See, this particular beast, others like it, are actually described in other places throughout Revelation. Other prophecies make it clear they represent a series of regimes that have controlled the territory once ruled by the old Roman Empire and all those succeeding it. See, John describes the woman riding on a beast. Notice that in verse 1. "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and he talked to me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk on the wine of her fornication.'" See, this great harlot that has this influence that extends beyond the confines of the old Roman Empire, but who is she? Who is she that yields such power? Obviously, it's not a real person. Like the beast, she's symbolic. Notice verse 5. "And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery." Notice Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth. So we see her identified, and she is given this name, Babylon the Great. So you have this great system that is anti-God, that is opposed to God, and she is given this name of Babylon. Drop down now to verse 18. "And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." So again, they're tying it back to Babylon. We see that name. This time, though, it's not limited to a city. Babylon is now personified, given an image. She's portrayed here as a harlot, a prostitute, one that seduces, influences the destinies of the world. Now, we saw earlier, you know, described the physical Babylon was a great place, but at the same time, it was very dark. It was rotted to the core. And that's what you're seeing here, again, is this whole system. You see this system that is magnificent and great and powerful on one level, and underneath, within it, it is rotted to the core. And you can read through chapter 17 here. It describes a violent, turbulent world, a world that's dominated by this woman on the beast. Together, they're preparing the inhabitants of the earth to fight against the returning Messiah. So although that we have unprecedented prosperity and progress, like I say, it's magnificent, it is powerful, it shines. But that system was bought at a price. We're now beginning to face up to the fact that our civilization has some critical, perhaps terminal problems. You know, history has shown us, and I think we're even living through this right now, it doesn't take long for a desperate, frightened world to become even more selfish and cruel. And we're seeing that. I mean, we're living that today. It's going to get worse. But we're being scared into all these different things. You need to do this. You need to do that. And is it getting more peaceful? Is it calming down? And no, it's not. You are seeing the cruelty, the hatred that's coming to the fore on these things. See, in a time of crisis, even the most freedom-loving people are willing to surrender some of their rights, some of their freedoms, in the interest of preserving their lifestyle, their values. They're willing to give it up. Are we not seeing that kind of thing even today? So the book of Revelation describes humanity that is now held in that grip of such this totalitarianism, superpower. So this harlot woman of Revelation, it represents a system that is coming that dictates the way the world ought to work. And we hear a lot of that being talked about today. They're not able to, at this point, make you do that. But don't you hear that an awful lot? People out there telling you what you ought to do. See, those that go along with the decisions of this system are going to survive. They're going to prosper. You know, come with me. I'll make sure you're taken care of. This system wields her authority through a military economic superpower. The symbolic beast. It imposes its harsh regime on the world. Decides who lives, who eats, who starves, who trades. Takes its cues from the rigid regimes of the past. It's going to make the decisions on who gets what resources. Who can produce what. It's going to be ruthless. It's going to be efficient. And it's not going to allow any opposition. It is the ultimate Babylon. It might not be ideal, but it's going to seem like it's going to be that's the only alternative. You know, that when you look and compare that to a complete collapse of the world economy, we're going to go with this. If we give in with this, we'll prosper. So that's the way they're going to go. The Bible tells us most of the world is going to cooperate with this system. They're going to want to prosper. They're going to allow this Babylon increasing control over all aspects of life. Economic aspects, political aspects, military aspects, even religious aspects. It's coming. Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17. Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17. since he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So it talks about what that economy is going to be like. All those that go along with it are going to prosper. You know, you see this mark of the beast, and people will go out and tell you all kinds of things about what it is. You know, for you've even seen the ones, I'm sure, about the vaccination was the mark of the beast, that they were somehow implanting something in there with the vaccination and all this kind of thing. I don't know that that's the case at all, but the scenario is being set up for such things to happen. Who's going to fill these roles in this nightmare, this vision of the future that we see here in the book of Revelation? You look at it, in some ways, the book of Revelation is like a screenplay. The script has already been written. The main characters' roles, the roles of these main characters, have been established. But the cast, who's going to play those roles, has not been chosen. See, the nations of this world are like animals. They're being herded into a trap. They feel the pressure that's driving them in these new directions. They may still snarl and snap at one another as their old animosities, their old hatreds begin to surface. But what they don't realize is all the whiles are being driven to the brink of absolute ruin. And from behind, the woman riding the beast, behind her is another power, the evil genius of Satan, the ultimate power, the god of this world. This is his effort to deceive mankind. And he's using religious, political, economic, military superpower here with the beast. He's using that to direct the destiny of the world according to his will, the way that he wants it to go, the way he wants it to end. He only has one goal, Satan does. See, in the Garden of Eden, he attempted at that point at the very beginning to thwart God's plan, to derail it. So once more, at the time of the end, this is his last chance. Babylon the Great. Again, we see Satan behind the scenes. He's never been more tempting or more dangerous. See, now he's getting desperate as well. See, across the centuries, God has allowed mankind to make mistakes. But like a watchful father, he's never taken his eyes off of us. He's never lost sight of the purpose for creating us. And what you're going to see is, as the world begins to groan under the yoke of Babylon the Great, it will once again be time for God to step in, to intervene, to come to the rescue. See, mankind at this point, blinded by Satan, they're all going to be thinking that there's no other choice but to submit to this oppressive system. What choice do we have? If we want humanity to survive, what choice do we have? But in that case, when you go that route, you find that freedom and mercy, love, truth cannot survive. One or the other. So again, we see where God will intervene into the affairs of Babylon. Go to chapter 18, Revelation 18, verses 1 through 3. Revelation 18, starting in verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. You try to think of that. You know, picture in your mind this angel. Earth was illuminated with his glory. Verse 2, and he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, has become a dwelling place for demons, a prison for every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So Babylon the Great, at that point in time, may have been ruthless with all those that opposed her, But everything worked, and it worked well for all of those who went along with it, with this system. For those that cannot see through her deceit, Babylon seems to be that last hope for preserving civilization. So God cuts her off at what seems like a high point of her success. As you reach that pinnacle, all those that go along with it. So what happens now is going to seem like a disaster. Verse 9 and 10. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city of Babylon, that great system of Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." This is going to mean the collapse of the world's economic system. Notice it says in 1 hour, and whether that means literally an hour, we've taught that it means a very short period of time. It's going to be stunning how quickly it's all going to collapse. Verse 11 through 13. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her for this economic system, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of the most precious wood, bronze, iron, marble, and cinnamon, incense, fragrance, oil, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, bodies, and souls of men. So it's talking about a vast international trade. Think about today. We are there. International trade in the modern world has become this one vast, intricate network. Remember, what was it, a couple of months ago, that ship that got caught, what, in the Suez Canal? Gummed up trade for, what, a week, 2 weeks? Billions, trillions of dollars was dependent on that one ship in one canal. So massive deals are made at a touch of a button. Fortunes hang in the balance one way or the other. Messages go back and forth between computers at the speed of light. Cargoes are sold, resold, diverted again before they even get off of a ship. Then, as it describes here, in one awful hour, says the screens go blank. Telephones stop ringing. Intricate system that's so delicately balanced, so carefully controlled, so ruthlessly enforced. The system of this final Babylon the Great suddenly ceases to function. Just instantly. Verse 15. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour," again, 1 hour, a very short period of time, "such great riches came to nothing." Reminds you of Nebuchadnezzar. "Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What is like this great city?'" In other words, what are we going to do? "They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she is made desolate.'" It's all going to come crashing to an end. Instantly, suddenly. So surely only an enemy of mankind would want to see this level of destruction, would want to see mankind destroyed in such a way. So when Jesus Christ returns to take over the governments of this world, when he comes to establish the kingdom of God on this earth, at first, he's not going to be greeted as a liberator. He's going to be seen as the enemy, as a usurper, as a threat, something, someone that needs to be oppressed and suppressed and overcome. It's interesting. I don't know if you've ever read the Catholic version of the end of the world and what's going to happen. It's quite insightful reading. It's basically exactly the opposite of what the Bible teaches. And it teaches that Jesus Christ will come and be the Antichrist, and that they should go out to meet the one that's coming. It's quite scary to see how it's all set up. So what is actually the greatest city or the greatest day in history at that point in time, the greatest economy from Babylon the Great, is now going to be thought as a calamity. Christ is going to return. He's going to establish that new world order. He's going to pick up the pieces. He's going to bring peace and love and cooperation, harmony among the nations of the world. The exact opposite of what Babylon stands for. But at the dawn, at the very beginning of this new era, it's going to seem like the end of the world. People are going to be distraught when they see Babylon being crushed. Satan will have done his work well. People are going to hate Jesus Christ when he initially comes. Nothing is going to be salvaged from this greedy, this selfish, this ruthless, this evil empire. You know, there's nothing in there that's going to be brought over. You know, you're not going to stand around and say, well, I like this, and I like this, and I like that. No, none of that. It's all going to be wiped off because it's the opposite of everything that Christ stands for. The antithesis of what he hopes to do, to accomplish as he begins to rebuild this world. See, the Babylonian system has to be purged, has to be utterly removed from this world once and for all. So finally, let's go to Revelation 18. Revelation 18, verse 21. It says, then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city of Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. So it is going to be totally removed. But as a system that's going to be ingrained in those that are still alive at that time, that system is not going to disappear easily. It's going to take time, you know, for that memory to fade, because it produced a way of life. It produced a certain set of politics, of economics, of religion, of dealing with problems, all these things that it produced that are in total opposition to God's way of life. That's the only thing that people will know. This way of life is based on human reasoning, human understanding. And it's aided and it's abetted by the thoughts of Satan, these perverted thoughts that he has. It has persisted on earth from the very beginning, started in the Garden of Eden. So it's not going to be changed overnight. You know, when the millennium gets here, it's not going to be like somebody flips a switch and everybody's going to change their mind and look up and say, oh, okay. They have only lived their life one way. They've only known one way. They're going to have to unlearn things. See, Christ cannot build his new society on the foundation of the old. It's totally different. He cannot use its systems. He cannot use its administrations, its habits, its customs. Those that have been educated, been indoctrinated in the ways of this world, this old system, are going to have to be re-educated. Christ is going to have to start again. New administrators who have learned over the centuries to think like he does. Those that have proved to be competent, loyal in applying his laws and his government. You know, he's extending that to us, to you and I. Again, it's going to have to be an effort. The Bible emphasizes no one can know exactly the day, the hour of Christ's final intervention in the affairs of mankind. But there are ominous indications reveal that this final Babylon, you know, the parts and pieces, as I said before, are out there. They are all in play. It's just going to take that one thing to click everything into place. It's going to be foolish. We would be foolish to ignore what's going on around us. So the story of Babylon is a sobering one. that old city that's buried beneath the Mesopotamian plain has come to represent human society as it develops apart from God, anti-God, if you will. It has been both the pinnacle of man's achievement and the millstone around his neck. When the angel lifts that millstone, symbolically casts Babylon the Great into the depths of the sea, the weight of everything that it represents is going to be lifted off of human civilization. And when Christ returns, he's going to replace that with a kingdom that the Bible tells us will never be destroyed. It will go on forever and ever. And so that's what I've got on Babylon. I hope that's been helpful to you, to help you to understand what has happened in the past, what is yet to happen. It's coming. It's something we need to be very much aware of. Thanks, everybody, for coming.